This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
So first of all, thank you all for coming. I hope you can hear me. And I want to thank Sina Najafi so much for all of his support and all of his work putting this series together. And I'd also like to extend my gratitude to the panelists. Thank you for so generously donating your time and your expertise. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on the questionnaire. So just before we begin, I'm going to give you a very brief overview of this series as a whole before launching into tonight's event. So the thought behind the series was to analyze the magazine as a medium by analyzing three sites of interaction between editors and their contributors, and sometimes also their readers, namely the interview, which was the subject of an event we held here last month, which is recorded and available online for those of you who missed it, the questionnaire, the subject of tonight's conversation, and the letter to the editor, which we will discuss on June 18th. And not only are these the few sites of interaction available for magazine editors to get feedback from their contributors and readers, but also they often clarify or articulate or expand a magazine's platform. And some of the questions that we will bring up and address tonight will be why a magazine or an editor might issue a questionnaire, what kinds of responses they hope to receive, what they think of the responses they do receive, and how those questions and those answers, again, articulate, clarify, contest a magazine's platform. And I'll also be curious to hear from our panelists how the questionnaires they've been involved in relate to their own work. So just to give you a sense of the format, I'm going to begin with an overview and history of the genre, and then cede the floor to each of our panelists who will speak in turn, and then we will discuss the questionnaire both amongst ourselves and with feedback and questions from you. So to begin, I want to first define what a questionnaire is. These are often known as inquiries, symposia, roundtables, forums, polls, and they're broad, open-ended questions that magazine editors issue to their contributors, such as, where is painting going? Why do you write? And can a photograph have the significance of art? And I've chosen these three examples simply to demonstrate that this is a decidedly international phenomenon. Questionnaires have been issued consistently since the late 19th century through the present. So I'll show you a series of examples that I've come across in the course of my research. Historically, the questionnaire has had a close relationship to the manifesto. And this is an example of a manifesto and questionnaire that were published in back-to-back issues of the Argentine magazine Martin Fierro in 1924. So in its manifesto, which inaugurates the magazine, they announce a new literary sensibility. And then subsequently in the questionnaire, they ask, is there a new Argentine sensibility? And so you can see precisely how the questionnaire calls into question the terms that it so stridently announces in its manifestos and other declarative texts. And typically, the manifesto is a forward-looking pronouncement that is signed by one or many contributors, but is a singular text, whereas the questionnaire, by contrast, invites multiple voices, is a space for doubt, for ambivalence, for contestation and debate. And so you can see that how that functions a little bit in this example. Often questionnaires are more retroactive or historicizing, whereas manifestos are often inaugurating movements and magazines. And I brought in this example of Art Forum's 1975 survey on the obsolescence of painting to demonstrate how those fragmented responses might look visually in the magazine. So here you see that the editors brought in images of paintings by the contributors, artists such as Alan McCollum and Donna Nelson. And I would say that much like these images resemble a kind of group show in print, similarly, the questionnaire responses are linked only by their juxtaposition, that they're often disjointed and create a kind of non-linear reading experience. So another issue that I'm interested in our panel panelists addressing is the look and feel of the questionnaire. And this is an example of a questionnaire which Sylvia Kolbowski responded to, the artist questionnaire, also on obsolescence, but in a different vein, in 2002, and you see that there is a text, there's text along with images, and I'm again curious to know how you feel about making these editorial choices and your reaction when your responses are printed. So that, yeah.
May I just say one thing?
Yeah, of course.
Some of us wanted to end October at 100, just punctually, and the compromise was that we'd do an issue on obsolescence. It's just a little anecdotal.
Yeah, no. The questions I'm going to raise is how you can see certain questions persist throughout the century, and one of them is obsolescence. So, thank you. So that is a little bit about why a brief overview of what a questionnaire is, what it looks like, and now I want to briefly address why a magazine might issue a questionnaire, why a writer or artist might respond to a questionnaire. So here you see a questionnaire from 1922 asking, who is the greatest painter in Mexico? To which Diego Rivera responded that he is the greatest painter in Mexico. So you can see why he might respond to this. But from a commercial point of view, just purely commercial point of view, questionnaires might stoke or respond to controversy. They might expand or create an audience or market for the publication. From an editor's point of view, they receive this material often at little or no cost, filling several issues of the magazine. And from a writer's point of view, this might be a low-stakes contribution to a publication and an opportunity to see your name in print alongside more established artists or writers. That is the most cynical commercial reason to issue a questionnaire. And however, I would argue that there are many other reasons why this might be the case, namely, both a magazine's editors and its contributors can assert a certain community formation. So here you see a visual compendium of all of many of the surrealists who responded to the inquiry on love. And this enables the editors to demonstrate support for the movement, for the magazine, and for the contributors to insert themselves into this broader community or movement. Although I do think this particular image demonstrates some of the problematic gender politics inherent to the inquiry on love and perhaps to surrealism. The surrealists issued numerous questionnaires. This is just one example. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, at its most utopian, I think a questionnaire can draw attention to a key or critical concern that underlies the magazine's platform or reason for being. And I think that's the case in the 1928 questionnaire, Revista de Avances, What should Latin American art be? So by asking this question, they're conjuring the category of Latin American art into being. They're demonstrating its importance. They're giving it authority and validity and requiring or asking their contributors from across Latin America to take this seriously as a formation. So those are kind of the range of reasons why a magazine might issue a questionnaire. And I also want to note that a lot of these examples come from the 1920s, which is the focus of my research, but also the height of literary and artistic modernism, of the historical avant-garde, and at a time when the magazine was a kind of prototype for a globalized, networked art and literary world wherein artists and writers could collaborate internationally. So one of the questions I have for all of us tonight is why the genre persists, why the magazine persists as a form, despite renewed opportunities for connectivity. I also want to briefly offer a very quick history of some precursors to the more modern or contemporary questionnaires. One is the questionnaire issued by the Berlin Monthly in 1784, asking what is enlightenment, to which Kant famously responded. And I bring this up for two reasons. One is to draw attention to the fact that questionnaires are often a site for philosophical self-reflection. And secondly, to demonstrate that questionnaires are often used to periodize. So this question of what is enlightenment is asking its respondents to reflect on their own historical moment. And I think this continues throughout the centuries, and I think you can also see legible in questions like the questionnaire on the contemporary, this opportunity for writers, curators to reflect on their historical moment as it is in formation. A very different precursor to the modern contemporary questionnaire is that of Proust, which is really more of a parlor game than the kind of open-ended invitation for philosophical reflection. However, he did publish his answers in a magazine, in La Revue Illustrée in 1892, and his questionnaire was subsequently taken up by Vanity Fair, which created this online interactive game in which you can compare your responses to those of celebrities. So my favorite answer to number one, what's your idea of perfect happiness, is Louis C.K. says, not ever having to fill out this questionnaire. So this is really more of a personal quiz and more of a parlor game than kind of open-ended philosophical or art historical self-reflection. However, I do think it demonstrates the appeal of reading more famous people's answers in writing. And also the kind of quick, playful format of the questionnaire, I think, persists. So some historical precursors that are a little bit more relevant to the genre as it functions today are the numerous enquêtes that were issued in the late 19th century and early 20th century France, such as this one, which asks things like, is Impressionism finished? Can it renew itself? And from this outpouring of questionnaires in France, the form was adopted by print publications internationally, ranging from the Political. This is an example of a questionnaire issued on the intersection of race and representation in the crisis, W.E.B. Du Bois's magazine in 1926, to more playful questions, such as that issued by the Little Review that culminates with the question, why do you go on living? And this was issued to Brancusi and Joseph Stella and William Carlos Williams and many others. So there's a real range of the kinds of questions being issued at this time. And I want to note two observations about these kinds of questionnaires. One is that many people refused to respond to them, but those refusals were sometimes printed, as in the case of Juno Barnes to the Little Review questionnaire. Ezra Pound also famously hated questionnaires, and often his diatribes were published. And I also want to note the relationship, or just bring up the relationship between this kind of literary or art historical questionnaire and the social science survey, which is something that I frequently get asked about. And social science surveys, are meant to tabulate data, and these kinds of questions resist any sort of empirical analysis. However, I would say that the prescribed form gives the questionnaire a certain authority or validity, and soothes some of the anxieties that structure it or propel it. For example, this questionnaire, which was issued in 1922, asks, do you think there's any chance of verse being displaced by prose? So this is anxiously being issued in precisely the language that it thinks will displace poetry. And of course, all of the answers say things like, yes, poetry is necessary. It's never going to be displaced. And so I do think there's something appealing about the bureaucratic, kind of technocratic language of the questionnaire. And I'll be curious to know what our panelists think about this tension between the prescribed form of the questionnaire and its very open-endedness. So I've put together this kind of overview of all of the questionnaires I've come across in my research, and I've published a version of this in Cabinet. And you can see, again, that this is just a ubiquitous phenomenon, and I've selected just a handful of examples to show you. I just want to note a couple things about this index. First of all, you'll notice that certain questions persist. I mentioned the one on obsolescence. There's a constant anxiety about the status of painting historically through the present, and also the kinds of questions being asked change as social and historical political contingencies do. So questions become a lot more political in the 30s and 40s. I also want to note that every kind of canonical artist, writer, theorist received and responded to these, from Jorge Luis Borges to Gertrude Stein to Clement Greenberg to Roland Barthes and Maurice Blanchot. So there's something, I think, intrinsic to the history of literature and theory and art that is indebted to the genre of the questionnaire. And lastly, I just want to cite a couple examples that I've come across in my research historically that might prove interesting counterpoints or conversation points with the questionnaires that October has issued, which I hope we'll discuss tonight. So when bringing up the questionnaire and the Enlightenment, I mentioned how the questionnaire is often used as a form of periodization or an opportunity for or an invitation for artists and writers to reflect on their own historical moment as it is still in formation. And that is also the case with these two examples. One is a questionnaire asking, what is modernism? and the other is asking what is the avant-garde. So I think that these serve as interesting precursors for the questioner on the contemporary, thinking about that as a art historical formation. Another precursor I wanted to bring up is this questionnaire on the cost of letters issued in the British magazine Horizon in 1946, which might be relevant to some of you in the audience. How much do you think a writer needs to live on? What do you think is the most suitable second occupation for a writer? A kind of devastating questionnaire to which George Orwell and Dylan Thomas and Elizabeth Bowen responded. And this might, again, be an interesting kind of counterpoint to the questionnaire on recessional aesthetics that October issued in 2009 and revisited in 2011, looking at the effects of the recession on artists and art institutions. And in 1995, October issued a questionnaire on feminism. And previous to that, in 1974, I just wanted to bring up the questionnaire issued by ArtRight, asking, do you think there is a shared female artistic sensibility in the work of female artists? To which I should note only Judy Chicago responded in the affirmative. But to demonstrate that certain kinds of questions are asked again and again, and that these have different meanings at different times and in different contexts. So October as a journal has issued numerous questionnaires. I've only addressed a few of them here. This particular questionnaire is about the relationship to artists and cultural institutions to the invasion of Iraq. So you can see that there's a wide range of the kinds of questions being issued by the journal. And I also want to note, and I'm curious to know both what our panelists and the audience think about this, that questionnaires are issued with great frequency by contemporary art magazines. So I brought in a lot of examples from the 1920s, but this really is a phenomenon that persists through today. So this is an example of one of the many questionnaires issued by Flash Art on the relationship between contemporary art and the United States. And Frieze Magazine issues questionnaires, I think, in every single issue of the magazine. This is one on art and politics. So again, in an age with opportunities for increased connectivity, the magazine persists as a forum and the questionnaire persists as a meaningful forum for debate. The last thing I want to bring up before ceding the floor to our panelists is the appropriation of the questionnaire by artists in the 60s and 70s. So here you see Benjamin Patterson's questionnaire from Flex Your Box, which is really a parody of the questionnaire, and Hans Haka's MoMA poll. And Haka continues to issue polls through today in his work. And this is something that I hope Sylvia Kolbowski will talk about in relation to her own work on conceptual art, but is something else I wanted to offer for discussion. So just to conclude, again, I would love to hear your thoughts, the panelists and also the audience, on why magazines might issue questionnaires, what kinds of responses you've received, and how the questionnaire, the questions and the answers align with the work of the magazine and with your own work. So thank you.
So I now know infinitely more about the questionnaire. So that was great. Thank you. For me, a questionnaire is neither an interview nor a manifesto, as Laurie suggested. Unlike an interview, it's not about an individual work or corpus that is completed. And unlike a manifesto, it is not about a group project that is to be launched. I think at its best, the questionnaire is an enquête, as the French say, an inquiry, even an investigation. For me, it doesn't ask questions so much as it raises problems. Its point is to make trouble. So I'm not interested in the whimsical version of questionnaires that sometimes crop up in modernist journals, nor am I interested in the unwhimsical ones that are more about party lines. If you read the old Surrealist journals, Breton was especially expert at this kind of enquête. The October questionnaires emerged out of the October roundtables. And Sylvia, correct me if I'm wrong, because Sylvia was an editor from 1993 to 2000. For its first 15 years or so, 1976 to 1990-91, October was an avant-garde magazine of post-structuralist criticism and postmodernist art. I think with the advent of post-colonial discourse and queer theory, it began to be somewhat reactive. That's just about when I became an editor, by the way. Its editors began to respond more than to lead. So our turn to the roundtable was one indication, I think, of this reactive posture. But to call it reactive is not to say that it wasn't critical. When we did a roundtable, for example, on the Whitney Biennial of 1993, or when we staged a discussion about abject art in 1996, we were very critical. But still, we didn't initiate the discourse. We came late. We crashed the conversation. So the roundtables opened up the magazine, but not much, at least in my view. Others were invited to speak, but the discussion was led by the editors. It was not quite the roundtable as Circle Jerk, but it was close enough. Yeah. I can't wait for your response to that. The questionnaire was a way to draw others in directly on their own terms. It was also a way to address a problem that no one person could be tasked with. We couldn't just say, comrade, you take on the question of visual culture. So I have a few examples. I'm not sure if you'll be able to read them. Do you want me to read it to you, or can you read it? Or I hate it when people read things that are in front of them. All right. Well, just in terms of background, this was a questionnaire that was composed by Rosalind Krauss and me. And in 1996, it came at a moment when art history was dissed as elitist, canonical, and so on. This is also the moment of the rise of visual culture as an academic project. So there was anxiety about resources, competition for students. It was the same time, too, that media programs began to poach on art departments. And there was a similar anxiety there about resources and students. We took on this passive voice to be distanced a little bit from it all, but part of the parlor game was to figure out who was the voice behind the passive voice. And I have to say that the first line of argument was, well, close to my own. So one, it has been suggested that the interdisciplinary project of visual culture is no longer organized on the model of history, as were the disciplines of art history, architectural history, film history, and so on, but on the model of anthropology. Hence, it is argued by some that visual culture is in an eccentric, even at times antagonistic, position with regard to the new art history, with its social, historical, and semiotic imperatives and models of context and text. At the time, I was very interested in the substitution or the displacement between art and visual and history and culture. I mean, that seemed somehow significant to me. It has been suggested that visual culture embraces the same breadth of practice that powered the thinking of an early generation of art historians, such as Riegel and Warburg, and that to return to various medium-based historical disciplines, such as art, architecture, and cinema histories, to this earlier intellectual possibility is vital to their renewal. This was, again, my feeling. I didn't really understand the opposition of art history and visual culture. I think, as I thought, I still think, that art history at its best in figures like Riegel and Warburg was always already visual culture. It always already had that extent of interest. There was a Warburgian turn in art history. I think it's still with us. But this had begun at that point as well. In a way, I wanted to suggest a difference between visual culture and visual cultural studies with this question. Three, and this is more Roslyn than me, it has been suggested that the precondition for visual studies as an interdisciplinary rubric is a newly wrought conception of the visual as disembodied image recreated in the virtual spaces of sign exchange and phantasmatic projection. Further, if this new paradigm of the image originally developed in the intersection between psychoanalytic and media discourses, it has now assumed a role independent of specific media. As a corollary, the suggestion is that visual studies is helping in its own modest academic way to produce subjects for the next stage of globalized capital. There's a sense, I mean, this was early in the digital age when the image world had somehow exceeded the articulation of spectacle given by Debord and others, even given by Baudrillard. And Roslyn was very taken by this idea of cultural revolution, this Jamesonian idea that somehow avant-gardes paradoxically produce subjects that are suited to the next stage in history, but the ruse is that that next stage is not determined by avant-gardes. Four, and again, this is more me, I think, it has been suggested that pressure within the academy to shift toward the interdisciplinarity of visual cultures, especially in its anthropological dimension, parallel shifts of a similar nature within art, architectural, and film practices. And the idea here was that art history might follow in this visual cultural register a turn that was very strong at this time in art practice, which was towards the ethnographic. So that was 1996. The next one? This one you can read, right? Okay. So I'll just provide background music. This is another one that is redolent of disciplinary anxieties, one might say, which I take to be serious. We can talk a little bit more about them if you want. Don't you remember this book by heart? Okay, pencils up. Then the last one, this hasn't appeared yet, but I thought I would share it with you anyway. Can you read this one?
It's a little harder to read.
So. Oh boy, this is a tough one.
You don't have to read the whole thing.
Okay, well, I'll paraphrase. Art history in the wake of post-structuralism, this is a questionnaire on matter and materialisms. Art history in the wake of post-structuralism has relied heavily on theories of subjectivity, actor network theory, object-oriented ontology, etc. They've challenged the centrality of subjectivity in the humanities. At least four moves characterize these discourses: to think the reality of objects beyond human meanings, to assert humans and objects that they form networks across which agency and even consciousness is distributed, in terms of ontology, to somehow value the being of things alongside that of persons. And then this interest in the Anthropocene, to think modernity in geological time. Many artists and curators are influenced by this shift. Is it possible or desirable even to decenter the human in discourse on art in particular? What is gained in the attempt, and what or who disappears from view? Is human difference somehow elided? What are the risks involved in assigning agency to objects? Might this be a new platform for politics? What is the relation of this new materialism to historical materialism? And then it's a worry about the reconciliability of these different positions, which for me is really essential to any questionnaire, any good questionnaire. So just one more comment or two. Again, I'm happy to go with you wherever you want with these examples, which is one thing. In her text in Cabinet, Laurie says the effective questionnaire can produce an ambivalent community. And I think that's right, and I think that's salutary. It calls up a group and also calls it out. I think the best questionnaires make that group a little divided, or at least make it uneasy, uncertain. I don't think there's an equation between community and connectivity, by the way. A related point, and I'll just throw this out here. I'm not really sure if I can argue it very well. But the category, it seems to me, of the public intellectual, well, it's a notoriously tricky one, not unlike the concept of the public sphere. Maybe it had existed once, maybe not. In any case, the public intellectual appears defunct now. But if public intellectuals are no more, what about intellectual publics? I think the effective questionnaire evokes such a thing. This is not the general intellect imagined by Marx, the dead labor of past workers encoded in the products and the gadgets around us. Nor is it crowdsourcing or hive-minding or wiki-braining. It is multi-dialogical, if that's a word, in a way that blogs rarely are. And I think it might even be a little, very partial antidote, an antidote of argument, to the general epidemic of opinion. And I think that's the primary reason why I value these things. That's it for me. What do you?
Oh,
I can also move slides for you.
So if you could put up that cover. Okay. Well, it was really interesting to hear both of these talks. First of all, to get Laurie's framework, but also to hear yours, Hal, because I realize that I'm coming at it from almost a completely opposing direction in a way. Well, only in the sense that I'm going to try to present something to you that I wrote down a note that you're saying, Hal, that what you think, one of the things that you think is salutary about a good questionnaire is that it calls out an ambivalence in a community. Or I actually think sometimes that can be profoundly problematic and unproductive, but maybe just in the example that I'm about to present. So in 1996, I think it is, 95, Mignon Nixon and I put together a so-called special issue of October on feminist issues. And we decided to send out a questionnaire. If you go to the next one, I think should be, no, okay, so no. Yeah, sorry, go back again. One more. So there actually is an introduction to the issue, to the issue in the questionnaire that I wrote. But reading it again in preparation for this, I realized that I wrote it after we received the responses to the question. Sorry? Is that cheating? I think I wrote it all afterward. Anyway, but that's kind of meaningful in one sense, which I'll tell you about later. So if you move to the next one. So these are the questions, and maybe I will read them out loud. So there were two questions, and people were the people who we asked to respond were allowed to choose one or the other to respond to, or I'm not even sure if they were allowed to do both. Recent feminist art and critical practices appear to be moving in various different directions. While some artists and writers continue to develop ideas, arguments, and forms related to 1980s feminist theories, focusing on psychoanalysis, a critique of Marxist and related political theories, and post-structuralist theories of cultural identity, others have forged a return to 1960s and 70s feminist practices, centering on a less mediated, iconographic, and performative use of the female body. Although significant for feminist practices, the work of the 60s and 70s did generate theoretical critiques of its overt or underlying thematic of biological or physical essentialism. In light of this, how can we understand recent feminist practices that seem to have bypassed, not to say actively rejected, 1980s theoretical work for a return to a so-called real of the feminine? And what roles do the continuation slash elaboration of the 1980s feminist concerns and practices play in the current arena? I think I may just read that one. And then the second one raised the issue of the terms accessibility being routinely opposed to elitism, and the kind of attack often launched against feminist theory, psychoanalytic or otherwise, as being elitist, and a kind of return in that moment to trying to legitimate grassroots feminist politics at the expense of theory. We sent that questionnaire out to, I think that what we did is something that was rather different from what October generally did with questionnaires, which is that Mignon and I decided to put together a list of a very big list and rather broadly selected list of a lot of the people who are usually didn't publish in October, didn't share our views, or maybe the more kind of extended views of October. And that, I think, was actually a big mistake. But so I'm going to read you a couple of excerpts from the responses. The problem with much 1980s feminist theorizing is that it is just too conceptually lax and intellectually self-indulgent for me to spend the little reading time I have trying to fight my way through its turgid prose in order to figure out what the writers are trying to say, only to discover, if and when I do, that their views are often vulnerable to quite elementary objections. I develop strong feelings of self-pity, neglect, and abandonment by a writer who appears to care so little, whether I understand her or not, that she is unwilling or unable to exert herself to observe even the most elementary, strunken white type guidelines of queer writing. I get irritated and start to suspect that this phlegmatic stance toward the act of communication is a sign that this piece of prose is not really intended to communicate at all, but rather to perform some other function, mutual celebration of the uninitiated from it in the way we used to do as little girls when we formed clubs in which only the members knew how to speak Pig Latin and could make an idea important by expressing it in a secret code. Wonderful days, but they're over now. And, you know, you're all laughing, but that's Adrian Piper. Then here are a few more. The generalness combined with an underlying tone of injury in your text creates a tautological "have you stopped beating your wife" effect. My and your heavy use of quotes already indicates a problem of definition, and because you refer so vaguely to the position of others, an impression is conveyed of hidden agendas and a needless ellipticality. That's Yvonne Rainer. Here's another one. I feel pretty sick of the good theory people, bad essentialists, presumption underlying your question. Joanna Drucker. I hope you're not in the audience. There is an unfortunate tendency, evident in the very question posed by October, to see theory in opposition to autobiography, and I mean, just get the general tone. I can read on and on. I don't think it's useful at this point in time to reassert highly normative typographies of feminists. So, you know, I think that when I did write an introduction after these came back, they... I can't believe I wasn't more traumatized than I was when it actually took place. But I knew that when you invited me to do this and I would have to read it again, I put it off for weeks. Because I think it was rather traumatic. And I think that in... I started to think about why the responses were so aggressive, because really the great majority of them were. I mean, we published 25, but I think we asked about maybe 50 people to write, knowing that, you know, we wouldn't get everybody to write. And I realized that there were several things that were problematic, because I don't think that the aggression that came out toward us was productive. I didn't see it that way then, and in reading over them again, I didn't see it. So then I started to think about, you know, when Hal asked me to join the editorial board at October, for which I have always been very grateful, I joined it at the time knowing that I would be in a somewhat embattled position because... you know, first of all, October is often a journal that everybody loves to hate. I think it's more light now than it was when I was involved with it. But certainly, because I think a younger generation has kind of come to be interested in it. But I joined it at a rather embattled moment. And over the years, I would go to, you know, cocktail parties or events or conferences. And for some reason, maybe because I don't have as much authority since I'm an artist and not... you know, historian, I would be told, the people would make accusations to my face about October. So these are some of the things I was told over the years when I was a co-editor. One, that, and this is at parties, by the way, that the editorial board of October determined all tenure-track academic hires in the United States.
Check.
That if an art historian from outside the U.S. had not published in October, they would never be able to get a tenure-track job in the U.S. Check. That the editorial board clearly had a list of who they would never publish and that they published only their friends. That the opinions of the board regarding texts were homogenous and that the board never read unsolicited articles. And actually, every single one of those is false. Obviously, the first two are false, but I can verify that the others are completely false. Every unsolicited article was read by like two or three editors. And there were many disagreements on the board. Anyway, so it raised for me the issue of paranoia. And no, but I mean, seriously, though... Now, the general Lacanian definition of paranoia would be that of a projection of an all-powerful other who pulls strings and, in effect, speaks and controls those who are subjected to the symbolic realm that the big other creates. However, this other, this is the Lacanian view, this other is inevitably revealed to not be all-powerful and consistent because, for example, the aims of the big other are not always met. So, since there is no such condition of absolute power and consistency, fantasy is used to fill in the gaps that exist between the other presumed to be all-powerful and the deficiency that actually defines the other in order to reconstitute the consistency of the other. This is why Slavoj Žižek says that fantasy and paranoia are inherently linked. So, you know, what did we do wrong or right when we put that list together? We reached out to a very diverse group of people, included a lot of people who had never been published in the journal, and included a lot of people who had stances that were, you know, strongly different from what we, I guess, we aligned ourselves with. We framed the questions in a kind of opinionated format. You know, they weren't neutral questions. They did lay out, although I think they were quite bland in relation to the way that people responded to them, because there were a lot of qualified statements in them, but you could certainly read our positions through them. And I think we inadvertently played into the fantasies of the respondents, that the respondents had about us. You know, whatever the fantasies or the projection, the kind of paranoid projections were about October in theory, I think that's what we tapped into, and particularly by choosing people who had typically not published in the journal. Now, if I can quickly try to refer to a project I did called An Inadequate History of Conceptual Art. This is a project that, which I think is the kind of, has qualities that are sort of the diametric opposite of the way, at least, the questionnaire that Mignon and I were involved with played out. So this is a project that I did where I sent this question to about 60 artists, and I ended up videotaping the hands of and audio taping the responses of the 22 out of, I think, there were about 30 people that agreed to participate, and I managed to to tape about 22 of them. Okay. And then the piece was, the piece was set up so that the videotapes of the anonymous hands of the speakers were very large scale in one room, and the audio recordings of the artists' responses were in another room. And they were, I think the next image shows, the scale. So what was different about this? I asked, if you saw in the question, if you want to put the question back, the speakers, there was no framing of the question. And in addition, the speakers were asked to be, they were told that they would be anonymous, so they could not mention their own names. They could not mention the names of the artists whose works they were referring to. I think that the responses that I got for this work were rather remarkable. I mean, this is not a typical questionnaire, obviously. And they were remarkable in many regards, but one quality that they all had was that there was no defensiveness. There was a kind of openness and clarity rather than kind of acting out that I saw in the responses to the October questionnaire. And I think in part it was not just because of the limits that I set. I was, by the way, silent. In other words, I went, I recorded, I did not have a conversation with these people. They also knew that I was a junior artist in relation to the generation that they had come out of, so that in a sense I was the one who was seeking their knowledge. And I think knowledge, the question of knowledge and paranoia is really a big issue in regards to the questionnaire in general. In fact, according to Lacan, the issue of paranoia is essentially about a crisis in interpretation and therefore always relates to the question of knowledge. So in any case, there were many reasons why the project that I did with an Inadequate History of Conceptual Art didn't set off that kind of reactivity and that kind of defensiveness. And I think in part it had to do with the way that silence and anonymity played out in the work, so as to set up an almost what some critics have referred to as a kind of transferential setting, so that, and what happens in transference, you know, when for example, in the psychoanalytic setting, when there is the analyst who doesn't speak and the analysand who does speak, what the point about the transferential setting and the transference is that transference can absorb difference. It can absorb a difference of opinion in the room. It can absorb a different reading, a different conception of a reading of a condition or an event. And I think that in the psychodynamics of the questionnaire, particularly with a magazine as loaded as October in many regards, that just doesn't happen. The kind of rolling in of a productive difference of opinion. At least I didn't find it present in what we engaged with in that issue.
Should we watch a brief?
Oh, I don't know if it's that necessary, really. Okay. I mean, we have the video, the little excerpt, but I don't think it's that relevant, really.
Okay. Do you want to respond to
that? Oh, come on. Don't we all want to see a little excerpt from it?
Okay.
I mean, you can't tease us like that.
All right.
The piece I'm going to talk about was, let's see, it must have been early, mid-70s. And it was a performance at 112 Green Street. And it was in the evening. This is when 112 was very funky, and you know, green. Remember, just seeing a lot of green paint crumbling off the walls. And this was a performance that took place in the elevator shaft there. And the artist was in the elevator shaft, and he was going to invite three people to come into the elevator shaft and to stick pins in him. And I found that a very strange thing. But I think what was strange there was because there was quite a lot of people there. I can't remember how many, maybe 50, 60 people. And I think what struck me about the whole thing was the audience's response. Because the elevator shaft looked, it had that kind of greeny kind of paint that old lofts had. And it had a little kind of window that you, there was, I remember seeing a kind of, I never actually saw the person in there. Maybe I did, I mean, sort of lying down. I think I saw him lying down with just his pants on, lying on some kind of table or something through the window. And then, but there was a kind of a guard at the door saying, you know, we weren't allowed in, and then look through. But it looked a little bit like a kind of an execution chamber. I thought, this is a very strange kind of thing to look at. And but the people there were sort of festive. It was like a kind of, it struck me as a little bit like a carnival. I mean, people had wine and were like standing around and talking about when's it going to happen and who's going to go in there and do this. And people were joking, saying, well, what if they stick the pins in his eyes? Or they stick them in his kind of, you know, in his testicles? Or they're going to stick, I mean, where are they going to stick these pins? I mean, who's going to do it? And I don't can remember exactly what was going on, but it seemed like we were there for like an hour. And people were starting to get really impatient. And you could see people were starting to get really pissed off that they were like, had to stand there and hang around. And it was like, it wasn't getting unruly, but it was, you know, it was a little bit like a carnival show. I mean, I was thinking, what am I doing here? I mean, why do I need to look at this, you know, see someone, you know, get stabbed with some pins? I mean, and then someone said, okay, we're going to start. And everyone really wanted to be selected to go in to do this. And then all of a sudden they opened up the door, and then I remember saying, oh, it's this frenzy here. It's frenzy here or something. And then people said, oh, it's a setup. It's a setup. He's only going to have some kind of friends to come in, so, you know, they'll probably stick him in his fingers or something, and they're not going to stick him in his eyes, and he's not going to... it was really a very strange response. And then the door opened, and somebody went in and came out, and then somebody else went in and did it. And I, nobody ever saw where the pins were stuck or how they were stuck. And that was it. It was like it was very anticlimactic. I mean, in the sense of there was no kind of drama. But I guess the reason why I'm talking about it is that it sort of stuck with me for a long time as to what this was all about. And I guess the question was what it wasn't about. And I guess I think maybe the reason why it stuck with me so long was it wasn't about sort of aestheticization of objects. I mean, it was about kind of, I guess it was about tension, the kind of psychological space between people being invited to penetrate this person's body. It really had a lot of questions. And the danger of it. The temporalness of it.
I never made the connection between body art and questionnaires, but in terms of aggressivity, but there's a way in which body art very quickly devolved into a psychosexual theater that was a stage for signs of aggression or shows of aggression.
Mm, that's interesting.
I mean, rest in peace, Chris Burden. One thing I wanted to say in relation to your comment, Lori, about the non-response to the questionnaire, and in relation to your comment about aggressivity, Sylvia, there is, a real point of interest in how people don't respond or over-respond to these questions, and I think the failed questionnaires are when people, respondents just get caught up in the terms of the question. And every time I've attempted to do a questionnaire, I've thought about how that could be obviated somehow. But I think the unsaid or the oversaid is a crucial dimension to the questionnaire. And I think when one looks back on these things, as people like Lori do, that'll be the real site of reading. And I mean this almost in the classic sense of social art history as practiced by the young T.J. Clark. It's precisely what people misdescribe, misremember, as they're invited to do in your piece, where the discourse breaks down or repeats or again goes over the top. That's really where the interest lies, it seems to me.
Yeah. I would agree with you in general. I think that's absolutely true. But what I noticed in reading them again is that I think what was there were two things that were overdetermined. One is in the sense that you were just describing, which is this fixation with several terms. And also, for example, the way that got overdetermined in the feminist issue, where there was an inability to notice that there were qualifiers in the questions that we put together, right? So they read them as black and white, but they, in fact, were not black and white. But what I think is really problematic is that what they were responding to, I guess that's what I was trying to say in my setup here, what they were responding to was, let's say, 50% the questions and 50% October. And that's where neither one was particularly productive in some way. I agree with you that the one that could be seen retrospectively as more productive in analyzing it, because it is for me, is where it's overdetermined around the very split that I was describing, right? In the questions, right? The very splits that are being referred to is where the reactivity was coming in, the kind of overdetermined reactivity was coming in. But they were so loaded with projections around what October was seen to be that I don't think there's much to learn from that unless you look at it in relation to theory in general.
I would say historically that is often the case, wherein the respondents are responding to both sometimes the editor personally, certainly the magazine, And it's interesting to hear you read out those responses, which many of which are much livelier than some that I've come across in my research. So for someone like me, I'm always excited when I hear dissenting opinions and very adamant, very strong feelings. And I'm always struck by the fact that the editor chooses to include those dissenting opinions because they could undercut the intention of the questionnaire in the first place. And to me, part of my interest in the form is that balance between the editorial voice, so who has the final word, and this opening up to everyone's opinion and creating that place for dissent. And it's interesting to hear you say a failed questionnaire. I mean, I'm curious to know what would make a successful questionnaire, because you don't necessarily want or expect everyone to agree. You're just trying to frame a question in such a way that...
Yeah, but what I mean is that there was so much acting out, in my opinion, in these responses that nobody was really... Well, there were some that were fine. There were some that were interesting, but there's so much lost in the sense that the issues weren't actually being addressed that well, you know, seriously or that well.
And conversely, I think it's not very productive for a questionnaire to be a yes or no question like the one I showed on female, female artists have shared female sensibility. So, often.
You know, but even so, I mean, we're all that we just said about the unsaid and the oversaid. I do think they can be discursive instruments. I mean, they're not always invitations to react or act out. And even though, you know, you mentioned ambivalence, I mean, that was really Laurie, not me. I'm more interested in the contradictions that emerge in the responses. So I think you can still go back to the visual culture questionnaire and find a moment which a fairly limited community, but not an exclusive community, we did reach out, really wrestled with the stakes of art history defined in a certain way, visual culture defined in a certain way. And I also feel the same about the contemporary questionnaire. I think that really helped push the discourse along. And there was a range of response. Again, it wasn't too phobic. So, but I'm, you know, I am interested in this whole question of aggressivity and response.
Well, I think the difference with ours was that we invited people who we knew to be anti-theory to respond. I mean, maybe we were being masochistic, but...
that's a good first question in a questionnaire.
Hal, I would just like to ask you one question about your presentation, which is, I was struck by you describing roundtables as responding versus leading, the kind of reactive posture that enacts. And I guess I'm thinking broadly, is what is optimal for a questionnaire? I mean, is that necessarily a bad thing to kind of call together various figures and enable them to talk about something that is already circulating in the discourse rather than initiate a new topic of conversation? Maybe that's what the forum is intended to be. I don't know.
Yeah. We have this impulse to questionnaire when we, or maybe I should just say I, sense an emergent problem that cannot quite be defined in the usual terms. Too often we thought we were expert enough to wing it, and that thus we would go to the round table. But that became quite insular. But I think that they're really useful when you sense that there's this discursive formation on the rise, but you can't quite articulate it. You can't even name it. And that's when it actually helps to have lots of blind people feel the elephant, because then you at least begin to have a description.
But I have a question about that, and I think it has, the answer might have something to do with the way, is something that I think most people don't imagine about October, but when you have that kind of feeling like something is sort of nascent and it's just kind of coalescing and you want to know more about it, do you not solicit articles, because in general October doesn't solicit articles? I mean, when I was there, I started to ask why we didn't do that more often, and I was told that it just didn't work out very well, and I tried to do it, and it just didn't work out. And so I'm wondering, you know, why have like 30 people respond in a brief way to something when you could, let's say, if you have that feeling that something is being formulated just nascently, why couldn't you reach out to three or four writers whose writing you admire and take seriously and say, you know, would you be willing to write on this subject because it's close to something you're doing, or because you're somebody who we think would be, you know, have interesting things to say about this? Why a questionnaire?
Well, I think actually that has happened. It happens in all magazines, but I think that the topics that we've addressed with the questionnaire would be very difficult to assign to one person. I mean, not only for practical reasons, but just because they need to be described as variously as possible, so that one can begin to understand what the theoretical stakes are, the political stakes are, and to have one voice.
No, I don't mean one voice, but you could certainly ask three or four. I think in some ways the questionnaire at October anticipated the way the internet, not anticipated, I mean it was sort of functioning the way the internet already does. I mean, you say that the questionnaire is the antidote to the kind of, let's say, singular opinion of the blog. And I think that's a very interesting point. I agree with that. But in a way, this tendency that developed at October when I was there to get the brief responses, it's almost like reading, you know, something online in a way, right? It's the attention span is different, the kind of, the way you can scroll. It's almost like a kind of anticipates the scroll.
Anyway.
That's not an insult. I'm just saying, you know, it's, I know that if there's a topic that I want to know more about, I don't know that I would go to 30 brief responses. I'd rather go to a couple of articles, but maybe that's just me. Hmm.
But don't the fact that 30 people are responding to it suggest that it's, again, that formation has weight and authority that a selection of articles might not.
But that's something the editor constructs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's an intention maybe to do that, which is interesting, but...
Yeah, for me it's more implicit. I mean, whenever I did a questionnaire, I didn't know. I barely knew the questions, let alone the answers. I mean, I really didn't have any idea what the proper response was. That's what motivates a questionnaire. I mean, for me, it might sound naive and no one will believe it, but that's why. It's not to, call out for particular sectarian responses. It's really to ask the question.
But I don't think commissioning articles can be that. It has to be that different.
Well, perhaps not, but yeah, I don't oppose them.
It's just the difference of depth is what I'm questioning.
Hmm. Maybe we'll take some questions from the audience. So feel free to raise your hands. You know, we'll come find you if you have questions on questionnaires. perhaps to get us started, I just have to ask... So I'm always curious about this as a historian of the questionnaire, how deliberately or consciously as editors you are kind of contributing to that ongoing history. I feel like a lot of people are familiar with the surrealist questionnaires, perhaps, which again are more playful, but less familiar with perhaps the enquêtes onward. Mm-hmm. And if those play into any of your decisions in terms of the kinds of questions that you issue or the form as a kind of form that is inherent to the magazine.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think we had much sense of the history of the questionnaire, to be honest. But I do think the questionnaire is one answer to the question, how do you attempt to be polemical in an age that cannot support manifestos? So, you know, in a way it's, when you said, I said, it's somewhere between an interview and a manifesto, I think that suggests the discursive quandary of critical journals like October. That's why I began with this little sketch. I think October really began as a modernist journal in the old sense, in the sense that it wanted to identify new positions, advanced positions, and morphed according to the times when that kind of authority became impossible. I mean, it always amazes me when people project all this authority onto October.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the Wizard of Oz, you know. It's like,
well, that's the Lacanian view, the yeah. other behind the other. But, you know, I remember how that, because I think as an artist/editor, I was much less aware of kind of historical precedents in that regard of form. Not obviously in art, yes, but not so much in publications. But I remember being very struck, because I've never forgotten this, that I remember at an editorial meeting in October that there had been a number of exhibitions on Bruce Nauman. And so one of us, or a few of us, brought up in the editorial meeting, brought up the issue of, you know, responding in some way. You know, what was the phenomenon? Why suddenly four major exhibitions around the world on Bruce Nauman? I guess this was obviously in the 90s when I was there. And I remember that, if I'm not speaking out of school, that Annette Michelson said, who was not interested in our doing something in relation to that, and the reason that she gave was she said, we at October do not react. You know, it was a pronouncement. And I thought, wow, that, I guess that in a way that's been true. But I do remember that from that moment onward that we did react. But I'm wondering, what was it that changed? I understand what you're saying, Hal, but I really think it must have been something a little bit different. You think it was the somehow some recognition on all our parts that, you know, that it was no longer that it was absolutely no longer possible to inhabit an avant-gardian position, right? Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling it was something else as well, that somehow revolved around, I think maybe I know what it is, because, you know, was it so common before that moment for four retrospective exhibitions around the world to take place at the same time around one figure? There's some institutional change occurred, mm-hmm. you know? And so the fact that we started to do all the roundtables and interviews, which October, I think, had never really done, and the questionnaires, somehow was, I think, in part a response to certain institutional changes and globalization, you know, and starting to see certain patterns that felt strange not to react mm-hmm. to.
Well, I mean, again, to be reactive is not to be uncritical, and it's yeah. also not to be unprogressive. I mean, there are advanced positions that can't come out of our reactivity. But I mean, just to take up your example, I think that's when we did a roundtable on conceptual art. And it was just at the moment when conceptual art came back as a genre that was truly global. I mean, not a genre, but a kind of a way of working, a set of protocols that one could apply in almost any condition, any context.
It was always global.
It became an international language.
It was the moment at which it was perceived as being global. In other words, it had always been global, but it had
international.
Not.
I mean, I would say that, you know, the avant-garde journal of the early 20th century, it was an international network. It wasn't a global network. It had deferred receptions elsewhere, but it wasn't global in the sense that conceptual art, even more than minimalism, became a language that one could adapt.
But then the Naumann example is perfect, because the fact that these exhibitions take place, you know, that somebody could have four retrospectives at the same time around the world is part and parcel.
Right.
Does anyone have a question? Sorry, it's so hot in here.
It's not even summer.
Thank you, all of you. It was really fascinating to think about, so thanks to all of you, to think about magazines and questionnaires. But as I was thinking about questionnaires and how they work in magazines, I was thinking about teaching. I'm a philosophy professor, and one of the things that I thought, the closest thing that I ever come really to a questionnaire, are homework sheets that I give my students, which ask them essentially study questions, some of which are super open-ended, what did you think, some of which are, you know, what do you think the argument on page 32 blah, 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 is. But I thought, this is more of a comment than anything, but I wonder if you have any comments in response, because I think it serves exactly the same function of creating an intellectual public, so to speak. You set a stage via these questions so that everybody's thinking about the same thing, but then they proceed to think different things about the same thing. But it has this sort of two-step process, and if it works, you know, so success or failure or whatever, but if it works, you end up having a really interesting, surprising conversation, but about one thing, right, because you've set it up that way. And so, I don't know, I liked that idea that the big function in a magazine is this creation of a particular intellectual public and the way it structures it. So, I don't know, comments.
I have a couple comments by way of response. The first is, that reminds me of Alfred Barr, the founder of MoMA, issued a modern art questionnaire, which was really a quiz that he issued to his students, but it was subsequently published in Vanity Fair. And I do think that there's a strong correlation between the act of questioning as a pedagogical tool and also as a philosophical tool. There has a strong philosophical kind of rhetorical history. So I do think that many of the, especially more playful questionnaires, but explicitly that modern art questionnaire, were intended as quizzes by teachers. So I think there is a lot of overlap historically.
Yeah, I would just add that October began to do questionnaires about the same time that Thomas Hirshhorn did this little artist book called Les Politiques, Les Bêtes, Les Plaintives. And the words, you know, politics, the stupid, the plaintiff. And he would, this consisted of collages in which he would pose a question, which was really somewhere between a kind of moment of ambivalence and a profound contradiction. And one would be, say, a poster by the constructivist Gustav Klutsitz, great artist, but it was a poster that he did in the service of Stalin. Another was by a German artist in the service of the Nazis. And Hirshhorn scrawls on these basically photocopied versions of photos of the posters, things like, well, he did them in French, but he would just scrawl them in ballpoint pen, help me. I think this poster is beautiful, but I know what Stalin did. What to do? And it's, you might think that it's, faux naive, but I don't think so. I think it's it's an honest question, and I think for all the kind of insidious motives that might be projected onto October or other magazines, sometimes one asks a question because one doesn't know the answer, or wants to express a conflict rather than act it out, you know, rather than.
Well, that, yeah, but that's a very interesting and I think productive kind of inversion, right? Because it's asking the question without articulating the answer.
Do questionnaires usually articulate the answer somehow?
Well, the whole point of the questionnaire is the answers, in a way. I mean, it's soliciting the answers. Mm-hmm. When, I mean, to kind of
tie... But solicits an answer, and the viewer, the reader. He demands an answer.
Right, but it's at a different register. It's at a very different register. You know, for 10 years I taught in architecture schools, and I used to teach history theory to architects, architecture students. And I found that, you know, and I would give paper assignments, and I found that they just couldn't write. I mean, it was like a combination of having been badly educated in high schools, and then if you're attracted to, visual practices, often those people are not particularly good writers, and then architecture programs tend to have very few academic requirements. So, frankly, I got completely—I got so sick of trying to grade papers that were incomprehensible that instead of papers, I started to assign—and I did this for about 8 years. I assigned—I mean, they had to come up with questions, and they didn't have to answer. They actually were required not to answer them. So, you know, every week they had to submit two questions on each reading. And I have, you know, reams of this stuff. I have no idea if it did any good, but I do think that the articulating of the question, it's a whole other form, and mm-hmm. I do think it's really valuable and interesting, and the project that you mentioned it sounds fascinating, actually.
Other questions?
Oh. Yeah. I'm just struck as you guys talk about what a distinctive form this is, how relatively recent historically, how unlike other things that you might think would be like it. Questionnaire is. So, when do you go around and ask a lot of people the same question to see what the result is? Well, there's a tradition of riddles, but there you're looking for the one result, or you may go around and ask, like, you know, Chaucer has people do, what is it that women most desire, or something like that, and you go from place to place and you get different answers. But it's not for the purpose of collating them, it's to get to the answer that's the right answer. And it's also it's not like a comments section on the web in the sense that that's always linear. People are always reacting to the last comment, and hence it's also not like a Socratic dialogue where you've got one guy who's asking question after question, but each question is dependent upon the answer to the last. So I really like how your hermeneutic of contradiction sense that. One of the things that we're interested in with surveys is exposing contradictions inside particular survey subjects and then among the various subjects, the various respondents. And it just strikes me in listening to you guys that it does have a distinctive power in that regard, partly because we're all potential participants in it. Each of us as unknowing of the question in advance, and particularly the other responses in advance, as any of the other participants. So just for the sheer distinctiveness of it, the place it claims.
Thank you for that comment. And also, I would just like to add that while these are often circumscribed, namely, you have to be invited to participate, I do think that you as a reader can imagine your response, and that's part of the exercise and part of the way this is interactive.
But as you respond, Jeff, you're also asked to file through your own voices, and that can lead to real breakdown too. I mean, do I play the professor, or do I play the critic, do I play the insider? I mean, that in my own experience can just shut you down right away.
Is that the same guy who's answering each question.
Right. Yeah, thank you. Just one comment and then a question. I was really struck when you were describing the kind of earnestness of the questionnaire and the sense of qualifying the answers and how much, in some reading, that plays into the Lacanian notion of paranoia. The very sense that the other might not know or gives the indication that they might not know is precisely what augments or aggravates the sense of fantasy and kind of phantasmatic projection. So in a way, the more authoritative the voice, the sort of less paranoia, and the more there's this kind of openness, there's a sense of greater paranoia, the opportunity for more paranoia. And I think that the question that I had was this kind of bifurcated reading of the questionnaire in terms of the sort of symptomatic expression of a moment and a kind of generative expression of a moment. And it seems to me it's really the kind of doubleness of fear or the riskiness of risks, which, you know, under risky conditions one might just sort of collapse or act out, or one might sort of have this ecstatic moment where one sort of steps outside oneself and moves things forward. And I was trying to think really hard about how to read those together, whether, you know, there was a productive way of putting those two sides together. I mean, one might be historical, which is to say, you know, when Laurie goes back and looks at the questionnaire from 1996, the symptomatic moment becomes generative in a different way that it wasn't at that moment. But so it becomes recuperated, as it were, with distance. But I have to say, I'm sort of more attracted. So that, I mean, that's one model. But another model we might imagine is to sort of push the two together more, and to think, what is it about the form of the questionnaire and the form of risk that it puts forward that pushes, that elicits, let's say, a certain form of discourse precisely in the open-endedness of the question. But again, the sense that the questions are not completely innocent, that you're sort of jumping into a space, and yet there's this expectation, and again, I think it goes back to this question of this big other, that the answer might be known, but maybe it becomes generative at the moment that the answer might be known in the sense that there is meaning. There might be an answer out there. It might not just be your blog or just opinion, you know, a comment on a response, or, you know, whatever you think is the answer in some kind of narcissistic way or in a kind of offhanded way. But the very sort of thing that you were diagnosing as a kind of big other paranoia somehow seems key to something of what makes the questionnaire generative. So I wondered if that might be another way of trying to think through these two readings of the questionnaire together.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Can I just say one thing in response to that? You know, I realize more and more, particularly in relation to what you were saying, that the Inadequate History Project doesn't really fit into the category of the questionnaire, you know, because I was at such pains not to set up a polemic, you know, and I think that the questionnaire always does have a polemic, right? I mean, explicitly or implicitly. But what I was trying to say, because in other words, you're not just saying, for example, write something about feminine essentialism and feminist theories of subjectivity. You know, I mean, it's not, you know, obviously the terms are woven into some kind of a polemic. And I think in every questionnaire that went out from October that I can remember, so, and even in this last one that you showed us, I'm not saying that it has to be a strident polemic, but, you know, but there is a polemic. And I think that is, I bet you that that is the case in every questionnaire of the kind that you were talking about, Laurie, also. I think that what I was trying to say with regard to the feminist issue is that what lay much too heavily as a kind of, in other words, that we sent out questions and the responses addressed the institution and its history, and not so much, I believe, the polemic of the questionnaire. You know, there was that kind of overdetermination that that where the psychodynamics of the situation determined the results. And I believe it's because we solicited responses from people who normally were not asked to publish in the journal.
That's true of the other questionnaires too.
I don't think so. I'm sorry. I know the lists, Hal. I don't think that's true. Maybe a few here and there, but anyway.
A comment and a question. The philosophy professor reminds me that perhaps that's also an earlier incarnation of this during an earlier model of knowledge creation and circulation during the Republic of Letters era when there were essay contests. And, of course, famously, Rousseau and perhaps many other philosophers mm-hmm. won these essay contests with that presumably were open to anyone in the Republic of Letters. So I don't know, that's one potential analogy. That raises the question of the hostility or the uneasiness. We're now in a different model of knowledge formation, creation, and circulation, namely the academic. And perhaps one difference between the current version of the magazine culture and the prior little magazines is that now it's much more edited and run by actual professors and academics, especially in the visual arts. And I'm wondering if that is one of the tensions that it creates, that there is a practical world of art making and a theorized world, which is primarily institutionalized in a particular university-type setting. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Just to respond to the first part of your question, something that I talk about in the course of my research is also the paragone, or comparison of the arts issued in the Renaissance, where artists were invited to advocate for the merits of their respective art forms. So I think there are a lot of historical precedents that predate the examples we talked about tonight, but that this really becomes a widespread phenomenon with the rise of print culture. And I would also say that I think while a journal like October is clearly tied to an academic formation, there are always artists and academics and theorists and scholars and people with all sorts of affinities involved in little magazines from their inception. So I'm not sure how much of a shift that is. But.
And Fries is not run by academics, and they issue a lot of questionnaires.
Yes, as does Flashard and many others.
And academics are not just blue meanies either. I mean, it's not an evil word in my vocabulary, always.
I think it's significant that October is not a peer-reviewed journal. I think it's significant in the phantasmatic formation, in my opinion.
I think we have time for one or
maybe
two.
One or two more questions and we'll wrap up.
So when I'm answering essay questions, I'm a current university student. Mm-hmm. Something that always strikes me is that when the question is very well phrased, I suppose, I don't notice that it's a question being asked of me for an essay, and I just sort of respond with what we've been doing in the class in mind. But when the question is not phrased well, for example, if it gives some assumptions that I wasn't expecting from what I knew of the class that I had, then I start to enter into this problem with the question itself and not with what the question is trying to ask me. And that sort of the earlier discussion of why the questions in October 71 elicited the really aggressive responses that it did, why that happened, and I thought maybe it wasn't the people that the question was sent out to, but how the question was formulated. And another thing that made me think that is how long those questions were. Just two questions took up one page, and that was very different from the questions that we saw in Lori's presentation, which were like five words. Very, very different from, I guess, the essay contest that Kant responded to, what is the Enlightenment? And there was, and there wasn't a description of, okay, first of all, let us tell you what we think it is, and then you respond to that. It was simply this very wide, open-ended question. And I'm sure that there were plenty of answers that were just out there to that question. But that question also elicited some really thoughtful answers. So I thought, oh, yeah, maybe we can make the question shorter.
I would just like to say that all of those short questions came with very long introductions from the editors that were then distilled into one central question, which I think you could probably make the same case for the questionnaires issued by October. So, but I also do agree that it's really difficult to formulate a good question or a good questionnaire.
One more question here.
Yeah, I have a question. I think this is for Lori, as the historian of the questionnaire form, but maybe other people have thought some. I was really struck by Hal's emphasis of how the questionnaire in October was a reactive move, and also Sylvia's kind of comment that the reaction to the questionnaire was tied up in a kind of paranoia over October's specter-like authority, as if Annette Michelson were stroking a white cat somewhere. And I'm wondering, between Lori's research on the 1920s and looking at the October questionnaire from 91 on, is this some weird variation of the old Peter Berger historic avant-garde, neo-avant-garde move? Something that was in the 1920s, a engine of the avant-garde explaining the new spirit of announcing itself and a kind of firming a change to something that, you know, reactive isn't the same thing as being reactionary, for sure, you know, but it is something that maybe is defensive, or that is something emblematic of October becoming a sort of institution at that point. I'm just wondering, has the history of the questionnaire, as it's gone from the 1920s to now, has it actually exhibited some sort of tendency in that same way, where something that was once kind of outside or antagonistic to the institution has in fact become an institutionalized organ?
Thanks. That's a really interesting question. And what strikes me initially is to say no, because I see this very much as a continuum, namely a lot of the same kinds of questions are being issued, but they're not consciously being reissued. So, for example, all of the questionnaires on the anxiety surrounding is painting obsolete or imminently obsolete. I think those are reissued in various geographic contexts in different places without prior knowledge of those earlier ones, which would suggest that instead of being a kind of reaction to the avant-garde, that it's more of a continuum. However, I am struck, and I agree strongly, that the manifesto is really a genre of modernism and of the avant-garde in a way that the questionnaire continues and persists and remains meaningful as a forum despite its ongoing use, perhaps because it's so often overlooked or under-theorized. I'm not sure what you guys think.
You know, did you want to respond?
No.
Yes, you did.
Well, I just wanted to say that there are other ways to work the avant-garde, neo-avant-garde logic, which is not simply to see the neo as repetitive, institutional, but as an activation that completes what was undone.
Yeah, that's true. But I do think that in another moment in history, it's possible that October would have ended and another magazine grow out of it, and then maybe we would have seen three magazines by now. And I think that, you know, it's a moment where these things are very, very hard to get rolling financially, and just in terms of any kind of publishing or institutional support. So there's, because I remember that before I left October, we needed funds pretty desperately, and I remember that I was told to approach Barbara Jacobson, who you probably don't know, all of you, but sort of bigwig in the art world, or a kind of gadfly, I guess you would say, in the art world. And I approached her to see if she had any ideas about how we could fundraise. And she said to me, "You know, Sylvia, sometimes a magazine just has to die." And You know, I think we all knew at the time. I don't know what happened after I left, but I think there was some discussion about, you know, maybe that was the, it was a moment to end and so on. And it could...
Barbara says
that could be your last questionnaire. Yeah.
But it could... should we close down, right? No, but it could, in another moment, I think, that when the project changed, the magazine might have shut down and some of the same people with other people might have put together another journal. But these things are just hard to, you know, generate from nothing. So.
Super. Thank you so much, all of you. Lori, Kyle, Sylvia.